Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're going to be talking about TV on the radio today. Wait, that sounded weird. Sounds like we're going to spend the whole hour talking about the band called TV on the Radio. What we're actually going to be talking about is television. And I just realized that's confusing too. But that's okay, because we will be talking about both the big black box with the pictures on it and the band Television, the first rock band to play at the legendary club CBGB's. We'll take a deep dive into their first album, Marquee Moon, later on the show. We've also got live music from one of Ireland's most popular rock bands, Bell X1, whose latest album has a New York connection, too. But let's start by talking about the other television. You know, the one in your living room. With the zombie series The Walking Dead coming back to life for a fourth season on AMC, many fans will hear this familiar theme song at the start of the show. But this is the age of DVRs and online viewing, so many fans are likely to watch this season of The Walking Dead in big chunks. In other words, they'll be binge viewing. Steve Knopper wrote about the impact that binge viewing is having on TV theme songs. Steve, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much, John. Nice to be back.
So, binge watching, it's a relatively recent phenomenon. Are we already seeing it impacting the way TV theme songs are handled?
Yeah, I think so. A little bit. I mean, right now there are series being made where music supervisors and so forth are they have in mind, they don't want people to be bored. They know people are going to be watching a show, you know, 10 times in a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't want people to fast forward the opening credits, because that's annoying and that might lead people to skip that episode of the show or move on to some, you know, any other of their hundreds of millions of classic movies or TV series that they could watch via Netflix or iTunes or whatever. So the theme song is important, and it is something that music supervisors and people who are creating shows are thinking about, for sure.
So you say in your article in the Wall Street Journal, which, by the way, folks, you can find on our website at soundcheck.org, you say that these shows come with main title themes that are built to withstand repetition. So the producers are thinking, hey, you know, we may not be getting all of our ratings on Sunday night or whatever. We may find that, you know, at the end of the month, people are going through 4, 5, 6 episodes of our show.
Right, right. I mean, mostly I think producers, as I say in my article, I think producers and showrunners and so forth are thinking, we just need a really good song, and we need one that creatively fits the images in our opening theme credits.
All right, give
so
us an example.
Something good. Well, a great example is, my favorite example right now is Regina Spektor's great song, You've Got Time, which is in the opening credits of Orange is the New Black on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those songs. The more you listen to it, the more you think about the different meanings of the song. And while you're watching, you have these close-up clips of prisoners' faces from the show.
Right.
And so it's got this juxtaposition of music and images that are really compelling. Now, when I talked to the music supervisor of that show, Bruce Gilbert, he said, you know, we were just trying to make a great opening theme sequence. We weren't thinking about binge watching. But nonetheless, I still think that it's the perfect example. It's sort of like you don't want to fast forward the credits. You find something new in them every time. So I think it's sort of the perfect binge watching sequence.
Remember all their faces, remember all their voices. Everything is different the second time around.
That is Regina Spektor's song, You've Got Time, which she wrote specifically for the Netflix TV series Orange is the New Black. And we're speaking with Steve Knopper. You can find a link to his Wall Street Journal article called The Golden Age of TV Theme Songs on our website at soundcheck.org. So she did write that specifically for this show, which is still pretty rare, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends. I think that there are examples of artists who write songs for shows. And then there's other great examples of artists whose songs obviously get picked up, like old songs that get picked up. The one that I use as the main example in my story is Forever Young by Bob Dylan, which a great classic song. I've heard it at many weddings, but was never a hit. And now that it's the theme to parenthood and has been for the last 3 or 4 years, you know, I make the point that people are listening to that song over and over again more than they probably ever did on Top 40 radio.
May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth.
Theme song from the TV series Parenthood, which you may know as Bob Dylan's Forever Young. So, Steve Knopper, if you're binge-watching either of these series that we've just talked about, Orange is the New Black or Parenthood, you're hearing a fairly substantial theme song. I mean, a minute 15, a minute 20 is an eternity in TV. If you're watching multiple episodes at a time, don't these shows run the risk that eventually you're going to get tired of hearing this long song for the fourth or fifth time in the weekend?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think people take different approaches to their music for the show. First of all, I don't think that either of those shows play both of those songs in their entirety, so they just play snippets of them.
Mm-hmm.
But there are different approaches. You know, The Wire played that great Tom Waits song, Way Down in the Hole, and
right.
They would have different versions by different artists of that.
You gotta keep the devil down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury.
You look forward every week to seeing those little snippets of images from the show, which is so great, juxtaposed with the song, and that was a great thing. But then there are also theme songs that kind of go in the opposite direction of that, like How I Met Your Mother actually has a snippet of a song that was by this band called The Solids, which was a band that the two creators of How I Met Your Mother used to be in. And that theme song is only about 15 seconds long. It's
right.
Only just a tiny, tiny snippet of the song. And the rest of the song sounds nothing like that snippet. I did an email interview with one of the creators of the How I Met Your Mother theme, and he said in syndication it's like 6 seconds long. And he said if current trends continue, the theme song will just be bah.
What about – all right, let's talk about instrumental examples. Steve Knopper's with us on Soundcheck. We're talking about the Golden Age of TV Theme Songs, the title of his Wall Street Journal article, which you can find on our website, soundcheck.org. Is it now the Golden Age of TV Theme Songs? Because I think many people would look back to, say, the 60s, the 70s, when you actually had TV theme songs that explained the setup of the show.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship.
The How I Met Your Mother creator made this point in my article, which is that back then, TV was this newfangled device. You know, you would watch Gilligan's Island every week and you'd have no idea what was going on. You might catch an episode and you'd never seen it before. So the creators of the song and the show felt the need to explain the entire plot of the show in the theme song, as I'm sure you recall. And it was the same thing with Star Trek and the same thing with many, many other kinds of shows, The Addams Family.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They're all together ooky, the Addams Family.
You know, and then as time went on, themes kind of changed. They became smaller. They became a little bit artier. You know, think of Cheers, where it doesn't explain what the show is, but it's you know, where everybody knows your name. It's, it's kind of this idea of juxtaposing a theme to a show that's just absolutely perfect.
Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name. And they're always glad you came.
And now I think we've hit this new point in this kind of inflection point in the way people are viewing shows, that it just has to be rich. It has to withstand repetition, like I say in the article. You know, some like Breaking Bad. I mean, that's part of the way the show is marketed, with that little near, you know, kind of. I'm sure I didn't sing that right, but.
Well, but, you know, you got the twang in there. That's the important
thing. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going for.
A little bit of the Breaking Bad title sequence from Dave Porter. Steve Knopper is with us on Soundcheck. We're talking about his Wall Street Journal article, The Golden Age of TV Theme Songs, and how the phenomenon of binge watching, now that we can see things on demand through DVRs and online viewing, has changed the way we perceive TV theme songs. So that Breaking Bad theme, it's instrumental and it's short, so it's both a signifier, Steve, and also something you're not going to get sick of very quickly.
I think that's true. I think that a lot of shows take that approach. I mean, looking at Lost and looking at there's other examples of shows that just do these little tiny bursts of music that are just incredibly distinctive. And then there's sort of the opposite end of the spectrum, which is Game of Thrones, which has this long theme, very distinctive, and then you've got a map. And you're walking through this map at the beginning of the show, and you're seeing where all the different kingdoms are. And every time you watch the show, you see, oh, yeah, that's where that is. Oh,
right.
Where's that? You know, it's the only map that you see in the entire show, and it helps you with the plot. And so there's different approaches to it. It's sort of like the rules have broken down, and everybody's trying a different thing. It's not one size fits all anymore like it was in the days of Gilligan's Island.
Some of the music from Game of Thrones, another of the TV series that people tend to watch in big chunks, 4, 5, 6 episodes at a time. You know, I can remember when The Sopranos started that, you know, my wife and I and our friends, you know, we would often catch up, you know, like at the end of the month, 3 or 4 episodes at a time. And hearing that song, Woke Up This Morning by the English band Alabama 3, you know, hearing that over and over again, you went through kind of periods over the years where you were sick of it, and then other periods where you thought, yeah, this really is a really cool song. And through it all, you were always kind of wondering, what's the connection between this song and this show that we're watching?
Woke up this morning, all that love had gone. Your papa never told you about right and wrong. But you looking good, baby, I believe that you're feeling fine. Shave my body, under a bad side.
And the interesting thing about that song is that it wasn't written about or because of New Jersey gangs or mobs at all. It was it was inspired by a story of a woman in England who was in the UK who was allegedly beaten by her husband. And then went ahead and took revenge and allegedly murdered him. And this was a celebrated case. This was a big deal in the media for a long time. And the song was inspired by that. And so when I talked to Mr. Love, he made the point that you know, as you're watching this show and you're listening to the theme song over and over and over again, you're going, like you just said, what is this about?
Yeah.
How does this relate to Tony Soprano? And then, oh, well, I want to find out more about this song and more about this case. And, you know, it's just a really interesting thing to listen to over and over again.
Now, Steve, in addition to the article, the Wall Street Journal also created a hashtag best theme song, asking their readers for their favorite theme songs. Do you have favorites out there right now?
Yeah, well, I'll be a little bit obscure, but I really love the TV show Veronica Mars, the one about the high school detective. And it has a theme song by this alternative rock band called the Dandy Warhols, which is called We Used to Be Friends. And it's just got this, even though it's a pop song and it's the kind of song that you could hear on the radio anytime, really, in any context, it's got this really spooky, mysterious element to it. You know, we used to be friends. Why aren't you friends anymore? Why were you friends before? You know, there's different questions that can be answered in the theme. And there's also, it fits the show and sort of Veronica Mars's shifting allegiances with her various friends at high school. Who can she trust? Who can't she trust?
We've been speaking with journalist Steve Knopper. You can find a link to his Wall Street Journal article, The Golden Age of TV Theme Songs, on soundcheck.org. Steve, nice speaking with you again.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
Coming up next, a live performance in the Soundcheck studio from the Irish band Bell X1. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Back home in Ireland, the band Bell X1 are arena headliners and rank as the country's second biggest live performance act, after U2, of course. But the band's latest album, Chop Chop, may be their leanest, most concise record yet. And it has a New York connection, as we'll hear in just a bit. Bell X1 is back here in our Soundcheck studio, and they're going to play for us today, including this song called Starlings Over Brighton Pier. Here's Bell X1.
Starlings of a Brighton pier, what do they know, what do they hear? They block out the sun. If there was one, like iron filings on the page, gather round leaders. I see faces that melt and flow. Old man's eye kiss. Starlings of a Brighton pier. From the buzzing of half-remembered things.
The Irish band Bell X1 live in our New York studio on Soundcheck with a song called Starlings over Brighton Pier. It appears on the band's newest album called Chop Chop. And let me introduce you to the members of Bell X1. Joining us once again in our Soundcheck studio, Paul Noonan, vocals and piano there. And you started the little electronic thing, right? The little tape drum.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Fluttering.
I like the way that, you know, most bands use that to kind of set the rhythm. Yours is almost subverting it, you know, with the kind of weird backwards thing that happens a couple
of
times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot of, I suppose, musical onomatopoeia in that song. We tried to sort of convey the murmurations of starlings.
Oh, very good. So you know the term for a flock of starlings, a murmuration.
It's the way they move collectively. They have this beautiful sort of collective movement.
David Garrity behind our drum kit and a little bit of ukulele and vocals as well. That was a ukulele, right?
It was a ukulele. It's a funny-shaped little instrument, yeah. This particular one, yeah.
Dominic Phillips behind the bass guitar and doing some backing vocals, and Bill Blackmore playing trumpet and flugelhorn here in the Soundcheck studio. It's good to have you guys back with a new album, and an album that has a bit of a New York connection.
Yeah, we recorded with Peter Kadis.
Who is the producer of Interpol and The National and a bunch of other New York-based bands.
Yeah, records and has made some records we've loved, you know, and we tracked him down, we stalked him for long enough that he finally relented.
Okay, guys, I'll make the record with you. Okay.
And Thomas Bartlett, the pianist who performs as under the name Dove Man and who's been here pretty regularly in our Soundcheck studio in various capacities over the years. What did he do, David, for you guys?
Well, he was, apart from wearing the producer hat, he was a breath of fresh air musically in the studio. I suppose, like with album 6, you're kind of going, right, how do we approach this? What do we do new? And he was the guy that just steered us in the right direction, made chop decisions.
Mm-hmm. And was he actually playing?
He played piano and Wurlitzer with his wonderful effects. So it was great not only to hear what he added to the record, but just to watch him work and the attitude as well, with himself and Peter, just really with decision making, which is, I think, one of the biggest difficulties musicians face, is actually, you know, deciding what avenue to go down and go down it.
When enough is enough. I mean, the title of this album, Chop Chop, suggests that there was some idea going into this.
Yeah. Well, for the first time, we had the title before we had any music made. We wanted to approach it with that sort of absence of cerebral ness in as much as we could, and to sort of.
You wrote a song about a murmuration of starlings. I don't think you got far enough away from the cerebral thing.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
musically speaking.
Yeah. We I suppose, you know, we used to be indecisive, but now we're not so sure. You know, there's definite sort of, we needed to make some changes. So we had a 2-week period, and we were very brutal about sort of leaving it at that. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, the last time you guys were here on Soundcheck was 2011, and, you know, the Occupy movement was in full swing, and, you know, we were talking about the sort of the fallout of the economic collapse back home in Ireland. What's the situation there now?
I don't know. There seems to be more vitality and, you know, as a direct result, I suppose there's loads of empty space around that people are now using for sort of pop-up shops and art, various, you know, I'm part of a collective that we've taken over a space for and created little studios and rehearsal spaces. Mm. And there's a lot of that going on. I think that's been a good piece of fallout.
Hopefully it'll become the new Berlin, Dublin.
not cheap enough, though.
A boy can
No.
No, no.
Not
no,
by a long stretch. The reason I ask is because, you know, there is this Irish tradition of music having a kind of storytelling aspect. And, you know, you guys have done that over the years. And I'm just wondering if, you know, the songs on the new album sort of reflect the current reality back home.
A little bit. I mean, there was a song on the last record called Sugar High, which I suppose was more sort of documenting that sort of the madness of the banks generally.
Right.
I mean, it was a pretty global thing, I suppose. But
that's a song you guys did for us here in the studio last time. And a great song, too. But you're here to play new stuff for us today. And do you guys need to, like, switch around positions again for this next song, too?
Yes. A little bit.
Yes, we do.
All right. So then you guys get to where you need to be.
All right.
And I will introduce this next song, which is called Motorcades. The band is playing for us live here in the Soundcheck studio and playing on Saturday, October 12th, at the Bowery Ballroom here in New York. Motorcades is the name of the song. Once again, it's Bell X1 live on Soundcheck.
They get a little nasty. You say I'm just showing off in front of the visitors. You say I'm going for cheap laughs. He's my offstage prompter. It's true, he helps me connect with my big Napoleon. I don't know what that's about. What's that about? We will receive you in the good way. It still smells a pledge. Pictures of our smiling faces. Stations of the cross of teeth and puberty. She cries at motorcade. She cries at motorcade. She cries at motorcade. She cries. Before you start, I'm not making fun. People cry at the strangest things. Mine is the Venezuelan national anthem. So many deepest of feelings. So much emotional porn. Public declarations. Windy words that fill the sails of empty vessels. She cries at motorcade. She cries at motorcade. She cries at motorcade. She cries. She cries at motorcade.
to stay. Little flags in our riders, shiny gloves that pop the seam.
X1 live on Soundcheck with a song called Motorcades, and that can be found on the band's newest album called Chop Chop. They're playing Saturday night at the Bowery Ballroom here in New York, playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. You know, earlier today we were talking about TV theme songs with Steve Knopper, who had written this article on the Wall Street Journal. Paul, David, do you guys have, like, TV shows that you're addicted to, that you binge watch, that you love the theme songs to?
Mine would be the Devil, yeah. Back in His Hole, I believe it's called.
Oh, The Wire.
The Wire, yeah.
Right.
The Wire,
yeah. Where down in the Hole, where they had the different holes. Versions.
Yeah, yeah. They had a Tom Waits version, and yeah.
Another good one was Justified. It was similar kind of vein, that kind of swampy,
right.
New Orleansy kind of.
Something with like those kind of Americana roots showing in it. Yeah.
Quite enjoyed that.
Okay. You're touring around. You tweeted out when you were in Philadelphia. Any requests? That seems like a dangerous thing to do. Do you do that often?
Yeah, well, we're trying to do it on every show, for every show on this. We've been doing it back home, and because people shout requests at shows, and you either haven't learned the song or they get lost in the cacophony, and so we're trying to put some order on the process.
All right, so tomorrow when someone inevitably requests Down in the Hole, yes. Will you guys be ready?
We will be now.
Yeah.
All right, Paul Noonan, David Garrity with Dominic Phillips and Bill Blackmore, the band Bell X1. The new album is called Chop Chop. Guys, great to see you again.
You too, sir.
Thank you.
You gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury at his command.
Tom Waits' version of Down in the Hole, used as the theme song for the TV series The Wire and picked by the members of Bell X1. By the way, they did another song for us in this session in the Soundcheck studio. You can find it on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, a different kind of television. We take a look at the legendary album Marquee Moon by the great New York guitar band Television. This is Soundcheck.
But
this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The punk scene in New York in the 70s centered around bands like the Ramones and Blondie and, of course, the notorious club CBGBs. This band, Television, wasn't just part of that scene. Some would say they created it. And while they didn't get the success of their cohorts, their 1977 debut album, Marquee Moon, remains an enduring cult favorite. In fact, the writer Brian Waterman recently wrote a book about it, and he joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Brian, welcome.
Terrific. Thanks for having me here.
So this, I'm sort of selling you short here. It's not just a book about the record. I mean, it's called Marquee Moon, but it really sets it in the context of New York, the literary and the music scene in the 1970s.
I did aim to write a book that would deal with the entire atmosphere that was going on, maybe from 73 to 78, with the album as a window onto that world.
So, you know, we're talking about artists who were aware of obviously recent things like the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed and Andy Warhol and the Beats, but also looking back to Baudelaire and Rimbaud and the French
poets.
Sure,
I mean, in part, I became interested in this project not just because I love this music, but because it was a nice intersection of the literary world in New York and the music world. It's this moment where people who had come to the city to become poets end up turning a corner and becoming rock musicians instead, and Patti Smith, Richard Hell, Tom Verlaine.
Right. Tom Verlaine and Richard Hell, the two who came here and founded television.
Right.
Patti Smith and Tom Verlaine,
had a
couple for
at some point.
For a while.
Right. Yeah.
There's lots of creation mythology around the scene and especially around television. It's said that television was the first quote-unquote punk band, and those are big quotes around the word punk in this case.
Yeah, and it's an interesting way to put it, too, because I think television has always felt a little bit hampered by being lumped in with the punk movement. I mean, their music ultimately becomes something bigger and other than most of what we think of
as
punk.
Almost the first post-punk band.
Right, that's right, that's right. And they certainly influenced an enormous number of post-punk bands, more than some traditionally punk bands.
But let's go back to the creation myth, because there are various ways this has been told of how television got to play at CBGB's.
Well, it's also, it's a creation myth that they contributed to very deliberately. And when I was doing work on it, I became almost obsessed about finding the first version of this story. Like, when did it first appear? I think the earliest versions I found turned up around 76, sort of on the eve of recording the album, at a moment when other bands from the scene were starting to become successful, and some members of television started telling the story to say, hey, wait, we actually found this place. We were there first. And sometimes some interviews, they predate it. They say, well, we found it in 72. Even though it was spring of 74, right? Yeah.
So, CBGB's the letters stand for Country, Bluegrass, and Blues. That's what Hilly Kristal, the owner, was intending to do.
What he did for most of the first year. I mean, the new music happened on Sunday nights, sometimes one or two nights in a weekend.
How did television convince him to allow them to come in on?
Well,
that Sunday?
That's the story, right? that is the story that the origin myth aims to tell. Most versions of the story involve members of television walking down the Bowery toward Chinatown, where they had a rehearsal space, seeing Hilly standing on a ladder, changing out the awning from the old version of his club, which was called Hilly's on the Bowery, and hanging a new awning, that's the famous CBGB awning. And depending on who tells the story, it's either Verlaine and the other guitarist from television, Richard Lloyd. Sometimes it's Verlaine by himself. Sometimes it's Richard Hell by himself. When Hilly tells it, Richard Hell is involved. But when Verlaine and Lloyd tell it, Richard Hell's not involved. So it's I started playing with that idea that we're not dealing so much with history here as we are dealing with it's a cult record, and we're dealing with the origins of a cult, right? I mean, sometimes people deal with it in terms that are very much like religion.
You use the term urban pastoral to describe the sound of the band Television, specifically on this album, Marquee Moon.
And I'm thinking also there in terms of the literary. There's a great book on urban pastoral in the New York scene that reaches back into the poetry of Frank O'Hara or some of the things that were happening in the 1960s that definitely were precursors, especially to Richard Hell's poetry writing. And so I was thinking already in terms of how does television fit into that literary trajectory? So urban pastoral, I think, works because it's in some ways it's a natural landscape, or it looks for a natural landscape in a very unnatural man-made one. If you think about the lyrics to a lot of television songs, you've find yourself down by the seaport, or there's a lot of talk about what you smell, the sort of the sights, the sounds that you hear. It's very much a landscape, a nocturnal landscape as well. So.
In the song Venus,
that's right.
Broadway looks so medieval,
that's
is
right, yeah.
A quote from Tom Verlaine. This is from the album Marquee Moon.
You know it's all like some new kind of drug. My senses are sharp and my hands are like gloves. Broadway, it looks so medieval. It seems to flap like little pages out of bell sideways.
Venus de Milo, but Venus de Milo. I mean, Tom Verlaine, very literary, artistic guy, and very precise in his guitar playing, and Brian Waterman in his lyrics.
Good, and I think also just precise in his sensibility. I mean, he's known as a finicky person to interact with at times. He's somewhat reclusive, and he definitely has his idea about the way things are and should be, right?
Brian Waterman's book is Television, Marquee Moon. It's about the debut album from the band Television. It's part of the 33 and a third series of books about classic recordings. Brian also teaches literature and culture at NYU. And you mentioned both Tom Verlaine and Richard Hell. First of all, not their real names, but names taken from French poetry, Tom taking the name of the poet Paul Verlaine, and Richard taking Hell from A Season in Hell.
That's
the Rambo.
Right, making some reference to that. So they become sort of Rambo and Verlaine. Again, you know, depending on who tells the story, they talk about whether or not that, how deliberate that choice is. Or
and
Verlaine,
like,
at one point said he just liked the sound of it. But
right.
It seems very precise.
But like the original Rambo and Verlaine, this relationship does not last. And by the time we get to this album, Marquee Moon, Richard Hell is off with his own band, Richard Hell and the Voidoids. They would have a hit with Blank Generation.
Which was originally a Television song.
Originally a Television song. So, I mean, how did these guys... I mean, they came here to be poets, right?
Well, to some degree, they definitely came to the city with the sort of bohemian aspiration. They you know, depending on, again, which version of the story, who's telling it, but they started telling stories in the early 70s about having run away from a prep school in Delaware and having gone down south and burned down a part of a field. You know, they had been teased by some rednecks. I mean, there are different versions. They both somehow got out of Vietnam. They at some point said they had convinced army shrinks not to draft them, I guess. And they the British rock journalist Nick Kent nods at one point to they almost have this sort of Mark Twain-esque The King and the Dauphin, right? They are these sort of figures who come into town and maybe have some Gallic nobility in their lineage, and wind up convincing a bunch of people that they're going to be the next big thing.
So they have this kind of aura, they have a look, and then once Tom Verlaine hooks up with fellow guitarist Richard Lloyd, they have this sound. And here's where the word punk becomes problematic, right?
Well, I mean, I guess over time, in the beginning, Television sound was very much a sort of post-New York Dolls garage revival, the sound of 1966. These are a lot of the things that energize other bands in the early 70s who are working on the underground here and in London are energizing them. And so they're looking for short songs and sort of rough chords. But then by the time Marquee Moon comes to be recorded, it's several years later, and these songs have taken on a kind of expansiveness that they didn't have originally. I mean, literally, you can, if you download all of the versions of Marquee Moon that are available online, all the bootlegs, you can just sort of line it up and just watch it creep from a shorter song into a 7-minute song, an 8-minute song, and eventually a 9, almost 10-minute song. In the version on the reissue, it's an almost 11-minute song.
Mm-hmm.
In some bootlegs from 1978, it's 16 minutes and 44 seconds.
It was epic. Without being a jam bandy kind of thing, this is the title track, Marquee Moon, from the debut album by Television. Moon, just a little bit from this 10-minute-long song from Television. Not the done thing around CBGB circles for the most part, but Television was not your average run-of-the-mill band.
You know, at one point in their live shows, they actually shared a lot with the Patti Smith Group in terms of incorporating improvisation into their live acts. And they had a few songs that could become 10, 11 minutes, like some of her longer songs, because they would improvise as they went. The words were always different. He would kind of get in the moment, get into his zone. And there's a little bit of vocal similarity in Verlaine and Smith's style.
Yes, too. That's been noted over the years. And as you mentioned before, Patti Smith and Tom Verlaine were a couple for a while. He is, Brian, he's still a reclusive guy, right?
I mean, he is. I've only had a few conversations over the phone and one in person. I had lunch with him and gave him a couple copies of the book. I would say, you know, he's shy, extremely well-read, articulate, and is a really, really interesting guy, and somebody who's interested in like the long artistic history of New York City music, art, movies and film especially.
He's been on Soundcheck as well and surprised me when he came into the studio by referring to something that I had done back in the 90s with the late Armenian-American composer Alan Hovhaness, and he was all excited about this, you know, improvisation that Hovhaness had done at Our Piano. You know, so of course I made him a copy and sent it to him, but, you know, this is a guy who listens to a lot more, clearly, than, you know, punk or post-punk or whatever we want to call the music that he and Richard Lloyd and the rest of the band were making when they did make Marquee Moon. Now, this was 77. By this point, a lot of the bands who had come to CBGB's after Television had already established reputations. They had record labels. They had, you know,
starting to get contracts.
Yeah, sure. What took so long for them?
Well, Television held out for the right contract for them. There was interest in them, and they did do some demos for various labels. You get the sense that they were almost waiting for the right deal, the right situation to come along. And it's probably a good thing that it worked that way, because these songs had 4 or 5 years to cook. They really honed these songs into really precise, beautiful works of art. Some people complain about the follow-up album Adventure, and it's true there are some older songs on Adventure, but for the most part, those are songs that were composed in relatively quickly, within a year following the release of the first album.
I think people forget that very often, you know, they say, well, what about the Sophomore Jinx? Well, Sophomore Jinx means that band has had like 1 year to put together a whole album, whereas their first album is often, as with Television, the result of an organic process over many years.
It's also true that some bands now record too fast, you know, and the record comes out when maybe they could benefit from a couple of years. But I think with Television's Adventure, one of the things that's true about that album is it's still better than a lot of stuff that came out in 78. In fact, I think that you can hear the whole post-punk American sort of college rock tradition of the 1980s embodied in both of these albums, so even in Adventure.
Adventure is the second Television album from 1978. It includes this song called Foxhole. Television. This is the follow-up to the album Marquee Moon, 1978's Adventure. And once again, speaking with Brian Waterman, author of the book Marquee Moon, about the debut album by the band Television. There was a long process getting it made. For a while, for just a brief moment, they were working with Brian Eno, the English producer, who actually cut a demo version of Marquee Moon. Listen to this. This is pre-LP, this is the demo version.
I remember I had a dark and double. I recall lightning struggling.
That's a rough demo from 1975, 2 years before the album Marquee Moon came out. Brian Eno attempting to produce television, and Brian, it didn't work out.
Well, what happened? I mean, Eno was brought in by a guy who worked in the British record industry, Richard Williams, and he was with Island at that point. And Williams had been instrumental in getting Roxy Music's career going.
From which Brian Eno came, right?
And for Island, he was working on a stable of kind of an avant-garde rock artists, kind of in the post Bowie, you know, wave. And so John Cale was recording with him. He had done a live album in '74 that had Cale and Eno and Nico. And so there is
Kevin Ayers.
Yeah, that's right. That's such a great album. And they're thinking in terms of New York. Clearly, with that stable of artists. And these guys were supposed to be the next big thing. So it made a lot of sense for Richard Williams to bring Eno in and record. And, the story goes a couple different ways again. Some say that Verlaine just didn't like the way that it sounded. Richard Lloyd, decades later, tells stories about Eno wanting to do really crazy art projects, you know, with their sound, cut the tape up and glue them back together.
Right.
Something he said to me in a conversation. And instead, what you got is what Verlaine thought sounded a little more like a surf rock, and he thought that maybe he was taking their influences too literally.
Well, what ended up coming out in 1977 was an album that put television back on the map with some of their cohorts, Talking Heads, who did work with Eno later, and Blondie and the Ramones. The album is Marquee Moon, and it is the subject of Brian Waterman's book of that name. Brian, thanks so much for coming on Soundtrack.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, it's the part of the show where I usually read off a long list of names of all the people who make this show possible. But you know what? It's the same group of people week after week, and we're all going to be back here again next week, too, except for one of us. Today, we say goodbye to longtime associate producer Greta Cohn, who's been with us for 3 years, producing interviews and check-aheads and telling us about the music of Hot Pants and lots of other stuff. Greta, and you're leaving us.
I am, John.
But not going far.
I'm not. I'm jumping just a few cubicles over, and I'm going to join the team over at Freakonomics Radio.
All right. So the Freakonomics radio show and podcast will be getting the benefit of Greta Cohn's services, which we've enjoyed for these many years now. You know, for folks who don't understand a producer's job, your job is not always to book things that you like, but things that our listeners might be interested in, right?
Sure. Things that people want to hear about.
But sometimes you do get a chance.
Yes.
To book some personal favorites. And so before you leave us today, I wanted to ask you for an example of something that we had here in the studio that for you was just like, you know, a personal favorite moment.
Well, I want to tell you about two personal favorite moments. The first was when the author George Saunders came in. That was a huge deal for me. I love his writing, and to meet him in person was really wonderful. And the second moment that I want to tell you about is the band Savages. They're this British post-punk band that I had the pleasure of seeing live in person first. And they put on this just dynamic stage show. They completely captured my attention. And then when I had the opportunity to bring them to the studio, I jumped on it. And I think they delivered when they were here. They pretty much blew me away.
Yeah. The four women of Savages, with only one record to their credit and already, you know, all kinds of accolades and acclaim. And it turned out to be pretty well-deserved.
I think it might be my favorite record of the year, if I may be so bold. Step in with that.
You're leaving. You can be as bold as you want. What are we going to do, fire you?
Well, I will miss you. I will miss everyone at Soundcheck.
Well, Greta, on behalf of the entire Soundcheck team, it's been a great 3 years with you. And we will see you Monday or, you know, the rest of next week and on down the hall. But we will miss you here on Soundcheck.
Yeah, I will miss you. Thank you, John.
Here's some of a personal favorite from Greta Cohn, the band Savages. And that's just about going to do it for Soundcheck today. Monday on the program, filmmaker Jonathan Demme will talk about how he's used music in his films during his Academy Award-winning career. And we will talk about his latest film about an obscure but gifted Italian musician named Enzo Avitabile. Also, some neat folk pop from the band called The Head and the Heart. That'll be a live session in the Soundcheck studio. See you back here for that on Monday. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.